I'm John Marty. I'm a state senator from Minnesota, not a U.S. senator, a state senator from Minnesota. And speaking tonight or talking tonight on the topic, a citizen's guide to lobbying, the ways of making an impact in politics. And I would intend this to be a fairly brief, I hope, general overview of it, because I think this is the sort of topic that lends well to more question-answer type of things than just hitting off on suggestions. So I'd like to give a general overview and then open it up for more than the normal 15, 20 minutes of questions. So be thinking as I go if there are particular things you'd like expanded on and so on. And the first thing I'd say about our role as citizens in the political world is, in a democracy, it's all of our responsibility. We are the government, even though we're not always happy with the way government is. It is our government, and in a democracy, we are responsible for being the change agents. And most Americans are unhappy with government in some way, shape, or form, I would assume. Virtually everybody is unhappy in some way or another. In some years, the polls suggest people feel president or legislature, governor, whoever is doing a pretty good job, but they still always have some things. Everybody's going to disagree with some things. And there are two responses we can have. One is the cynical response, the other is the critical response. I'd say criticism is very good, very healthy. It implies, I don't like something, I'm going to change it. Cynicism implies apathy. It's all corrupt, it's all a bad deal, it's all hopeless, I don't care, I'm going to just duck out. That's the least healthy thing. The slightly different version of being upset about something, the critical approach, is drastically different in the impact. It's, I'm going to be involved, I'm going to make a difference. Then once you've decided you want to make a difference, well, people come up and sometimes they have a great idea how we could solve some traffic congestion problem or air quality problem or whatever, education problem. They've got the solution, they know it makes sense, they've thought it all out, and now why doesn't it happen? Well, if you want it to happen and you think because it's a good idea and you believe in it strongly it should happen, well, find yourself a dictatorship and become the dictator, you win. In a democracy of 260 million people, or in a city council, in a city of 20,000 people, you are one in 20,000 or one in 260 million. You're not going to get your way on everything. Nobody does. And so don't be overly optimistic. But as people and people at Holden who are people of faith, we recognize we're in things for the long haul, and there are many times there are going to be frustrations, and you keep plugging away even if you don't come close to getting what you need. You start working at it, don't expect because you're trying to make a difference that you are the difference on every issue, because it just doesn't work that way. How do we have a way to change public policy? There are two basic ways, one of which is persuade the people in office of the merits of your position and persuade them to adopt public policies that way. And the second, and that one, there are several ways you can do that. I mean, you can get involved in the shaping of policies. Most cities and so on have citizen task forces to help shape environmental topics, and school boards have things related to curriculum sometimes. But get involved and shape it on task forces, committees, and so on. Second way is come up with an idea and give it to a public official that you think makes sense, and wow, that's a great idea, I'd like to try that. Or if there's an idea out there, or they're not persuaded of the merits of your idea, you've got to persuade them of it. And then finally, if persuasion doesn't work in terms of you've argued the merits of your argument and you haven't persuaded them, the other one is pressure. You try and build the political pressure to get the change you want. But persuading people in office is only one half of the picture. The other way to make change in a democracy is to change the people in office. And this is one where you elect people who share your concern or concerns, and you try and defeat people who oppose your concern or concerns. And this option is very political. It's very partisan, not necessarily in a Democratic Republican sense, but partisan in the sense that there's your side, there's the opposition. You're trying to sway people. Probably half the offices in our country are not run for on a partisan basis in terms of political parties, but I mean partisan in terms of the controversial winning and losing. You do have opponents. And some people, the first reaction is, well, I member of the League of Women Voters, I'll write letters to my congressman or to my legislator or the governor. I'll write letters, I'll make phone calls, I'll do anything like that you want. That's what we do as citizens, but get involved in politics, that's dirty, that's bad, that's something you shouldn't do. I'd like to suggest, no, that's an essential part of democracy. You are supposed to be working to produce and develop change. And both of these are the things I want to focus on. First of all, when you pick an issue, let me just arbitrarily pick an area, the area of the environment. You are interested, you are concerned about it. Could pick the copper tailings out here. You're very concerned about groundwater quality and the seepage of that. Well, first thing you do is you educate yourself on the issue. You try and find out what you think are reasonable solutions that have been proposed, what your position is on it. But the other thing to educate yourself on is the political landscape. I've gotten so many letters on bills that I'm the author of. Dear Senator Marty, please support Senate file such and such. This is an important bill, and I want you to support this legislation. I'm the author of the legislation. Of course I'm supporting it. It's amazing. I mean, they did enough digging to find out that this is the bill that they like or oppose, and they found out who their legislator was, and then they take the time to contact me. They could do a lot better if they'd find out, well, if there's any reason to. If you're strongly opposed and there's nothing they're going to do to change you, that may not be that effective. Or if you're strongly supportive, you're authoring the bill, that's not going to help. If you have some suggestions, if I'm authoring a bill and you think, you know, I really like this bill, but, or I'd like this bill if, and here's some suggestions, that's a useful thing to do, trying to modify it. But when you're trying to persuade somebody of a bill or something, it does help to know where they're coming from, and not only where your own, the person you're lobbying is, but where the political landscape is. Telling somebody that they really ought to go all out to support such and such a public policy when there's not a chance in the world that it's going to become law, maybe a little bit of a less productive use of your time. You want to focus your effort. So part of the educational process, and this is a good one if you want to get into further discussion on how do you find the good information about the issues you're caring about, and I'll just briefly suggest the major media is a very difficult way to find information about the political process. But since I picked the issue of the environment, you try and find an environmental group that's concerned about groundwater, if groundwater is your concern, and that's maybe active in the political process. I know in Minnesota, the Isaac Walton League is marginally involved in political things. The Audubon Society is not at all involved in political things. There's a Nature Conservancy which purchases land and trying to preserve land. Sierra Club is very politically involved. You find groups that share your interest and concern, and in their newsletters, their newspapers often will give you help on that. If it's a very local issue, a school issue, school board issue, sometimes you form your own group. And you find others who are interested in the same thing. You organize a group, maybe just for one time, one issue that you're concerned about. But the first thing you do is you have to educate yourself about the issue and the political landscape. Then let's get to the first of these two options that I mentioned earlier, not the one of changing who's in office, but the one of persuading people in office. The first thing that we often forget about when we're trying to persuade somebody about our cause is to educate. You, for some reason or another, feel strongly about a position, an issue, and supposing you're concerned about the impact of mine tailings on groundwater or surface water, and you're contacting your legislator, I doubt that the Washington State legislators representing the Lake Chelan area have a clue. They may or may not have a clue about what's going on here with the tailings and how they're trying to deal with long-term solutions to the water quality issue. So you got to educate. Don't assume they know everything about every issue, because politics is one of those places where the jack of all trades, master of none, definitely holds true. We are expected to be experts or informed about every kind of healthcare issue, every kind of environmental issue and land management issue and road construction issue and education issue and tax issue and you name it, we deal with it. I mean, government at state and federal level certainly deals with a pretty wide range of issues. Don't assume that everybody in office knows everything about everything, because nobody does. And frankly, some legislators or some public officials around the country are above average intelligence and some are not. And legislators tend to be, in broad general ways, reflective of the population at large, which is probably what the founding fathers of our country intended. They intended to have people who represent others. So don't assume they know everything. You've got to provide education about the problem and your solution, or why you support your position on the issue. Second one is you got to make the arguments on why it's the right. And again, some people will call my office, my secretary seems to sometimes talk at great length with people, some regular, almost pen pals over the phone. And they will call about every issue and go on and on and on. And she's been trying to find ways to get off the phone without being rude. I've often suggested, when somebody's got very detailed suggestions on exactly how we ought to solve every problem under the sun, tell them to put it in writing. It's amazing how that makes them much more concise. And frankly, legislators, their staff, county commissioners, presidents of the United States, they don't have all the time in the world to listen to somebody go on and on about their issue. So the more concise, the more effectively written or effectively brief and concise your phone call is, the more likely you are to have a positive impression. But try and phrase your arguments the best way you can. Figure out the counter arguments. And sometimes you may even want to say, the opponents of this are going to say this, but, and rebut them right away, instead of just, if the person you're talking to says, oh yes, okay, yeah, that sounds reasonable, they may not come back and say, well, the other side says this, and they may be thinking that in their head, so it doesn't hurt to rebut the other side's arguments ahead of time, because especially the higher up in the political chain you're going, the less chance you'll have to contact the same person twice. Less chance you'll have to make your point. So give your arguments briefly and concisely, and the other side's arguments, just say, the other side may say this, and here's why I disagree with that. Third thing you do, and this is one that's very touchy on how you do it, and that's apply subtle pressure. The most obvious way is get lots of people. Mm-hmm. If you write one letter, you're not going to have nearly the impact if 1,000 people write letters. At the state legislative level in most states, Minnesota and I'm guessing Washington included, if a legislator gets 1 or 2 letters on the topic, it really makes an impact. They assume for everyone who writes them, there are many others who are concerned about it as well. And they really do want to hear what people have to say, and you may have a real impact by doing that. Of course, the amount of attention they paid to it and the amount of work in your response, sometimes you can't tell, did they even read my letter or not? Did they get my phone message or not? Well, sometimes it doesn't hurt to put in a question in your thing. Well, can you support this? If you don't support this bill, can you give me the arguments why not? You tend to get a more personal response. If you want to just do the quantity thing, flood somebody with a lot of well-organized thing, people, groups usually will do, dear Senator, fill in the blank. I strongly oppose such and such, sincerely, fill in the blank. Well, frankly, when we get a stack of 100 cards like that, they get a same dear fill in the blank on the word processing. and you get about the same response, because you're not going to read each of 200 identical postcards separately and then respond. You're going to read one of them and then put up a response for all. But again, there is the pressure side of it there, the sense that you're going to have an impact that way. And the old political joke, I guess, of politicians saying, yeah, where's your stand on the issue? And he says, well, some of my friends are for it, and some of my friends are against it, and I'm with my friends. And that is a, politicians, like most people, like to get along with people, and they don't like to tell you they disagree with you, and they want to find a way to accommodate people. And so there are very definitely some people who say, yeah, I got 200 letters on one side and only 100 on the other, therefore I'm going with this side. Not everybody does that, and I don't think that's a good way to write public policy, but there are definitely some people who do that. So the subtle pressure that people put on public officials can definitely make a difference. Even if it's not providing any new information, it's letting them know there are more of us out there who really care about it. The caution side of that is to be careful about how you do it, making threats. Direct or implied doesn't win you a lot of friends. Think of it how you respond when somebody threatens you. It's not the kind of person you really want to go out of your way to please. And you wouldn't believe how many times, even times, it angers you, even when it's somebody you agree with on an issue. If you don't vote for this bill, that you may even be the author of, I'm never going to vote for you again, and I'm going to tell all my family and friends and relatives to vote against you too. Well, we don't like being threatened and intimidated, and that's not we politicians, that's we people don't like being threatened or intimidated. And so I'm suggesting when you are making sure people do this, letting them know that you've got lots of friends who also agree with you on the issue may very subtly add to the pressure, but there's a fine line, and you've got to watch not to cross it. And let me give just one little thing, because before the session started, we were talking about, informally, about the publicly financed stadium issues. And Minnesota is going through the same thing Washington State is on this. And one of the groups I've been working with, I don't like the idea of publicly financing these facilities for what are very definitely very successful private businesses. And one group that was working against it came up with a funny little, cute little ditty that they had written up and printed on a thing about a guy named George Petak, who was a Wisconsin state senator who had switched his vote on stadium and decided to go in favor of funding it with tax money after he had opposed it. And they had a recall election, was voted out of office. And they wrote a really cute little poem about how this guy had done it. And so if you don't watch it, the end of it was just vicious. I mean, so you do, we're going to recall you. Well, first of all, Minnesota's recall law wouldn't allow you to recall somebody for that, so it was an idle threat. And second of all, it was a threat, and people don't like threats. And I told them, you know, this is really clever and cute, but you could turn it, and I made it just a way so they were kind of pleading, please support this. And it was, I think it was funny and entertaining, and humor is not a bad way to make a point, and I thought that was a clever thing. But again, they came in there with the threat and intimidation, and that can backfire big time. So I'd strongly caution in the form of any time you're trying to contact somebody and persuade them of your thing, you can use arguments, you can let them know there's a lot of sympathy for your position or you feel strongly about it, but saying, I feel strongly about it and I'll never vote for you again if this happens, it's a watch out for that. Then, what are the tools you use? Well, the obvious thing you do when you want to communicate with somebody is tell them. The ways we do it in modern day life are letters, now email, faxes, telephone calls, visits. I mean, there aren't too many more ways you can do it than that, but a few years ago it was just a simple telephone call and letter and visit. Email, it's amazing how much email our offices get these days. And if you're going to do it, and if you work, if you're trying to just get in touch with somebody and let them know you feel strongly about something, it helps if they know you're a constituent of theirs. I get letters from all over Minnesota, and that's fine. And if they provide useful information that might educate me, a nice story or something that helps explain a situation or a concern, I'm going to pay attention to it no matter where the state is from. But if it's somebody who just says, I oppose this and I feel that this is the case in just three sentences, that you'll get 50 identical, not identical worded, but identical thoughts, and you get them on email, and you can't tell from an email address where they live, you know, it's just kind of, don't bother to respond, just because you're most concerned as a politician about the people who send you there, the people you're representing. So email works, but put your address and so on if you're a constituent. And fax is, again, the same thing. We got people who figured out they could send one fax to the legislature and have it be delivered to every member of the Senate. And so a lot of people just often ignore those. So make it clear that you're a constituent of the person if you are. If you're writing somebody who's an author of a bill that you oppose and wish they'd change, or a bill you support and you want to just thank them, or you wish them to suggest some changes in it, and they're not a constituent, make it real clear. You can still give them your address and everything else. Then those are the letters that I think are often very helpful to somebody, even if they're not from a constituent, and make it clear to them. I'm just writing to let you know how much I appreciate this. However, and I'm not a constituent of yours, but I thought this was a good idea. All those things can be helpful. And again, letters, always so much nicer to have word processing machines and so on, but still there's something to be said for if you're reasonably readable handwriting. People know that wasn't generated by a computer. They know you spent the time. They know it was a personal effort. And with all the sophisticated lobbying efforts nowadays by phony grassroots lobbying, where organizations will generate things that look like they're on your personal letterhead, we get so much of that stuff that you know wasn't generated by some individual putting deep thought into it. So I still think handwritten letters can have a real impact. You know a person sat down and wrote that.
Somebody described that as AstroTurf roots.
Yes, that's what it's been called. The grassroots efforts, that's not really grassroots, it's phony generated stuff. It's AstroTurf, artificial grass turf. Grassroots. I thought that was a clever name for that. And then finally, personal visits. Again, with all these things being polite, and if you can say something, even if you disagree with the person on an issue or you don't know, the more you can build a similarity, Representative so-and-so, your husband works with my spouse and I do such and such, and I really appreciate all you've done in this area. The more you can build common ground, the more we connect with people. So that's true in personal visits, other ways. And again, as I mentioned briefly earlier, it's not just you writing them, you contacting them. The more you can organize, that's what political organizing, grassroots organizing is. You find others with a common ground. Go back to the environmental issue. If there's no group that does or is concerned about the same issue you are, form a group, organize. It doesn't have to be a formal 501c3 nonprofit organization that's active in a whole range of things as a president and so on. If it's an issue you're concerned about, get a bunch of neighbors together and organize just for that one purpose. Okay, I'll talk to so-and-so, and we'll get these people to do this, and you try and do that. Very informally, the point is organize, get more people to share the concern. And then finally, you can do it by trying to sway public opinion. I've done it many times as a legislator, rather than try and argue with colleagues about why they ought to support something when they're not listening to the merits of the argument, turn public pressure on them. And you can do that letters to the editors, through newsletters that your company or your PTA or whoever puts out, put things in there urging people to do this, change public opinion that way. So that's all a helpful thing to do. The general public is best if you can get lots of people active, though it's hard to get people active. Grassroots organizing, getting more than one person, but certainly you yourself doing it. All of those things help. Now I'm going to turn real quickly to the other side of it, the changing the people in office. A whole lot of times, my wife works for an organization called Bread for the World, which works on on, it's a Christian organization concerned about hunger and poverty and seeking public policy changes that will help facilitate addressing those. They generate many letters to the editor, they have letter writing campaigns, and it's very effective. But there are many times the people they're sending letters to who absolutely no way they're ever going to oppose your concern, or on the other hand, others who absolutely no way there's ever going to support your concerns. And therefore, you can write letters till you're blue in the face. It's not going to change either those sides because they've got their minds made up. There are obviously a lot of politicians who are not their minds made up on every issue, or if their minds are made up, they're not that strongly made up that pressure and new information don't change them. But in those cases, your basic best solution is to change the people in office. And that means getting involved in campaigns. And the simplest way to be involved in campaigns, and obviously critically important, though the smallest thing perhaps you can do, is to go vote. And not assume you wait till November. In Minnesota, we've got a caucus convention system for nominating candidates in the parties. We also have a primary election that can overturn what the parties choose to nominate. And then the general election. And in every state, there's some form of primary election. And if you don't like the two people who are running in November, get involved earlier. Try and change there. Certainly voting, contributing funds. Our campaign financing laws in this country are pathetic. Like Minnesota, it's an issue I've worked on a lot. And in Minnesota, we've got among the best in the country. And I'd say our laws are terrible. Money talks in politics. When I ran a statewide race for governor a couple of years ago, it was the law I tried to pass, and I got watered down significantly, but I pledged to take no more than $100 from anyone. No lobbyist money, no political action committee or PAC money. And you couldn't do it. I raised $35,000 in first few months of the campaign, and my chief opponent for the nomination was saying, he's doing pretty good now, but he's tapped everybody. End of the year, I had raised a lot more than that, a lot more than he had raised. And, he's peaked, can't raise any more. Well, we didn't raise the entire spending limit because we have spending limits, voluntary ones in Minnesota. We didn't raise the entire amount, but we raised most of it. That wasn't the problem we faced. But I needed people to contribute money. And yeah, if I took $2,000 a person or an organization, it makes it a whole lot easier than trying to get 50 and 25 and $100 contributions, a lot easier. But everyone, every candidate, I don't know of any candidate who doesn't need campaign funds. And if you believe in somebody, putting your money where your mouth is a good thing to do. And the only way I can tell you why you should figure out it works is look at what the lobbyists do. They make in the interest groups. They all make big contributions. Nothing illegal. Nothing like bribery, because I don't believe it's direct bribery. I'm going to talk about this next week. But very definitely, they're investing money. In our baseball issue in Minnesota, the owner of the Minnesota Twins, who's pushing for public funding, they gave $35,000 to the legislative party caucuses, not to candidates. There are lots of people give money to Democrats or Republicans, or some of them give independents give money to both party candidates. I don't know anybody other than the lobbyists who give money to the Democratic Party and to the Republican Party. Which party do they agree with? Oh, both of them. Of course not. They're doing it because they want to gain access. They know it makes a difference. One, you can lobbyists know if the people get elected, money helps make a difference there. So some groups give money strictly to people they agree with because they want to get them elected. Others do it to gain access. In any case, money makes a difference in politics, and I think we've got to work to minimize it, but contributing helps. Volunteering your time. There are many ways candidates can. You don't have to have a lot of expertise in it, and unfortunately there are fewer and fewer people who volunteer in political things, partly because there's so many other things to volunteer for. And it seems the people who are busiest are the ones who are the ones you ask to volunteer, because they're busy because they say yes to things and they come through on it. And certainly there's a need for volunteers. And then finally, the other option is you run for office. If you don't like what's happening, the obvious way to do it is put your name on the line and say, run for office. And you don't decide, I mean, there are people who say, I don't like what's happening in this country, I'm going to run for president. And unless you're like Ross Perot and have many billions to put into it, you're not going to get your name in the newspaper anything other than as a comical joke. Even the perennial candidate I remember going up, Harold Stassen, who ran for president 10, 12 times, he's a Minnesotan, not my political party, just turned 90. I think he turned 90 last month. He was governor of Minnesota 60 years ago. He was 31 years old, youngest governor in nation's history. Great man. He was the sole surviving signer of the United Nations Charter. President of the University of Pennsylvania. Great career, very distinguished man, great thoughtful person, but he puts his name out as President of the United States. At one time, against Dewey, who got defeated by Truman, he was this close in a couple of states to having won the nomination, so he could have been president. But after that, he had this thing in his head that his way to bring out his one or two issues was running for president. He became a joke. You don't try for something that's totally unrealistic. On the other hand, if you don't like something, somebody's got to do it. And there are many people who, if you look at it this way, I could do better than that person. You've got to recognize that maybe it's something that somebody had to make a decision to run themselves, and that's something else to do. But basically, the two ways we do it are change the people in office or persuade those who are there what the merits of our case are. And I talked a little bit, I talked about half an hour, and didn't mean to go quite that long, but I hope that gives a good overview, and from there I see how many questions and ideas people have.
On the campaign financing.
Yes.
It appears that the Supreme Court has said that to stifle, that money is free speech. At least that's what
right,
I've
heard. Right, that's good.
And that really seems to be where we're at. And I wonder, can you comment on that?
Yeah.
Because they're saying if you stifle somebody who has $1 million, they have, the person who has $1 has as much right to speak, and $1 speaks as much as $2 million. I mean, in essence, that's what I think.
Yeah, you're very accurate in terms of what the courts are saying. I would say, and it is a very pessimistic situation. I'm going to have a full talk on this, I think, on Tuesday, calling government for sale, because while I don't think it's vote buying, as I said, I think it's very clearly an impact. And I'll go into some of this more detail then, but basically, the courts, you can find your way about it. Minnesota has voluntary spending limits. I've been author of a lot of the bills. Our entire system was under challenge, and the U.S. Supreme Court turned down the challenge a month or two ago. So our law is sound for right now. But we do it with a voluntary system. You get this public financing if you agree to the spending limit. And they have allowed contribution limits, a lot higher ones than I think they should be, but they have allowed contribution limits. And we have virtually all of our candidates, virtually all are abiding by the voluntary spending limits. This coming year, there are a couple of candidates for governor who are talking about violating it, but they lose all public financing. Their opponent is freed from the spending limit themselves. In other words, if I'm running against you and I say, forget the spending limit, I'm not going to agree to it, then you get all the public money that you're getting anyway, and you are now freed from the limits. You have a big head start in competing against me. That was something I noticed in the first time I ran, because we already had limits then, and my opponent spent 50% over the limit, and in exchange for a small amount of public financing, I thought, boy, he was really pinning me down, and virtually, well, half the candidates weren't abiding by the limits till we freed the other side up, and courts have upheld all that now. It still is a difficult thing, and one more comment on the court thing. They are correct in recognizing that free speech costs money. it's free, not in the sense that it's cost-free, but free in terms of you have the right to say what you want. And they recognize if I go out on the copper tailings and give a speech about the evils of our foreign policy or something, and you give the exact opposite point of view and you buy 30-second TV spots on the nightly news every night for the next 3 months, you've got more clout than I have. And they've said, hey, you've got a fundamental right that we cannot abridge to that free speech. I'd use the thing they're seeming to forget in campaign financing is the Equal Protection 14th Amendment, that if you compare it to our courts, if you're a criminal defendant, you have a right to legal counsel. If you can't afford it, you get it anyway. Well, we're saying here, if I got $1 million and I'm gonna buy all those TV ads, I get free speech. And even though it's a fundamental right of mine you can't take away, if you wanna have that same 30 seconds on TV every night, sorry, you're out of luck. And I think they're grossly misinterpreting that. And their theory behind all this is that we wanna encourage a big, wide, sweeping, diverse debate and the impact of it. They're not wrong in their interpretation of the First Amendment. They're wrong in their interpretation of the reality of the political world, where unless you take certain positions, nobody's interested in funding it, so you shut out positions there. And so I'm active with a number of other people in a number of states, constitutional scholars, who are trying to document the problem. Because I can tell the public, money talks in politics, and these interest groups are buying access, and everybody says, you're right, that's why I don't even bother to vote anymore. We understand it. The courts say, you got to prove it to us, you got to show us the problem before, you have to give us clear evidence of it before you have the right to infringe on this free speech right. So it's a long thing, and I'm going to have a whole talk on the issue of money in politics next week, so if you're on Tuesday. Yes?
If you can't limit campaign spending, could you possibly tax it?
See, there are lots of ways you can do things like, I mean,
you know, over a certain limit.
Yeah. You tax it heavily. You have campaign taxes. And I think that's one of the very creative ways that we have to go after, because I've seen campaign financing described as a balloon. And you squeeze it tight here and you clap down on here and it bursts out somewhere else. And the biggest one, and it really disgusted me, and both parties have done it, is now there are these independent expenditures. And because political speech in a democracy is the most important free speech we have, the most important speech, most deserving of protection. Commercial stuff, you can't make all kinds of outrageous claims about product you sell. We have consumer advertising laws that are very strict. The courts have allowed tightening down on that much more than political speech. But the independent expenditures, I can show you cases in Minnesota legislative races, which are quite cheap. I mean, compared to some other states, New York and California, where you may spend $500,000 or more for a legislative seat. Minnesota, our state house seats are only a spending limit of $24,000. And I've seen cases in rural Minnesota where legislators have, in the last week, they have $10,000, $12,000 dumped in their district by a totally outside group funded by some big money from elsewhere. That's half of their own candidate's limit. And they have no impact. We can't do anything about that, according to the courts. I think things like taxing it and other things are creative ways. The courts aren't stupid either in terms of trying to see us get around their things. They're watching that like a hawk. But I think there are things we can do, and part of it's documenting the problem. Yes?
What other issues besides campaign finance reform do you think contribute to cynicism about politics? And then do you think that we're more cynical now about the political process than we have been in the past?
I'll take the second part first, and if we get to come back to the first part, let's get back to that. I do think we are a little more cynical than in the past. I mean, I think we've got a dangerous level of political cynicism. I don't mean to suggest we've never had that. You go back 150 years and you read newspaper accounts of things. People took the gloves off then, too, and were taking pretty cheap shots and a lot of name-calling and other things. I think the biggest difference, though, in the cynicism is, I mean, Mark Twain and everyone wrote about all these snotty comments about Congress doing this and that. Will Rogers had his fun at things. So, you know, this isn't new. But I almost think that since Watergate, until that time, people had, I may hate those, this politician or these politicians, but this person's the president of the United States, and you better do such and such. And you can hate the person that's politics or think they're a terrible person for the job, but still, this is our country and our democracy and our president, and they deserve respect just because of that. And I think that somewhere in the last 20 years, we've greatly lost that. And so I don't mean to imply it was great at the beginning or it's hopeless now, because I don't believe either of those is the case, but I do think it is worse. And I think it's a dangerous level of cynicism. And the best way to measure that is voting apathy. And when half the people are not voting in the most visible election, the presidential election, I think we have to have very strong warning signals that we better try and change things. What causes the cynicism? I've got a couple of thoughts. I wonder if people here have any comments you want to make on other things you think that make your neighbors and others say, hey, the whole place is corrupt or cynical or hopeless. Any other things that you strike you as particular problems?
Well, the thing that just happened with the flood relief, you know, tacking on,
you know, other things.
Yeah, and all that kind of squabbling.
It's a good game, political game plan. I'll suggest one. The negative campaign attacks. And my wife said when we were gubernatorial race, and actually some of my local Senate races too, if she believed half the things my opponent said about me, she wouldn't vote for me either. And so you listen. Yes, most of the time in most races, you wouldn't want to vote for either one of them based on what the other one says about it. And the negative, cheap shot stuff is frightening, because it's always, I mean, hey, I disagree with every one of my opponents. I wouldn't run for office if I agreed with them. And I don't like what they stand for. I don't like how they campaign or anything else, but I don't think the fundamental way we ought to get elected for something is by taking the hide off the other person. You don't take the personal attacks, and you can point out things you disagree with, but I like to do it in the way that, here's what I stand for. In contrast, my opponent doesn't, or something like that, rather than say my opponent is a vicious scoundrel and a thief. And again, that's not new. I mean, the biggest change is we've got more sophisticated communications technologies, and we have more sophisticated political polling to know what works, and you got more sophisticated political consultants who read those polls and take those polls and run campaigns targeted by it. And the public hates the negative ads. They just hate them. But the thing is, they still vote according to them. They don't like the people who do them, but that's why you never have candidate X going, my opponent is such and such on the TV news. No, you don't even say, except the tiny disclaimer at the end of the ad, you don't say who's paid for it even. You have some ordinary person saying, this guy is a liar and a cheat and a thief. And they have the thing that the trick is to be as vicious and as negative as you can without looking like you're being vicious or negative or cheap. The latest one is you seem to accuse your opponent, even if they didn't do anything negative. My opponent is taking unlimited cheap shot after cheap shot after cheap shot. Why don't you write candidate so-and-so and tell him to stop this negative campaign? Well, you're accusing your opponent of, I'd say that's a major one. You're right, the political game playing, the flood relief thing going on for week after week. People are desperate and everybody agrees it's going to be done, but let's tack on other things. And that happens, that's not just Washington, that's in every state. The political game plan and the divisiveness on it. Again, as I told you, I don't want to be too harsh on this, because I think politicians, human nature, if people start talking with you, you want to agree with them. We all want to, politicians are very sociable people generally. They want to agree with you. And people do change their mind and all those other things. But too many times, I had an opponent once who accused me of being anti-environment because there was some environmental trust fund funding that I had not voted in favor of. These are often floor amendments to make it look like you're anti lots of things to get you on record. I was anti-environment because I didn't spend enough for it, and I was anti-education because I didn't, and I was anti-public safety because I didn't vote for this, and anti-this, but boy, did I love taxes. I voted against spending for every area that he would favor, of course, and then, but boy, I liked taxes, and he was going to cut taxes. Well, the public sees what happens there, and they understand that people are doing that. I think all of those things add to the thing, and the big money, I'd put it at the top of the list. But all of those things turn people off, and I'm sure there are a lot more, too.
Another thing, I don't feel as though I get good, solid information through the news media, something that educates me to the issues. It's, I don't know, it's more an emotionalism or a sound bite.
Right.
So in a sense, I get some sort of sense for things, but I don't get the real hard information that I need to feel like an educated citizen to the news media.
I actually gave a talk last week about politics by soundbite and what's happening to our political discourse. And the examples I used were Lincoln-Douglas debates 140 years ago, where you'd get 5,000 people coming to small town in Illinois, which meant obviously to draw that many people in rural Illinois in the 1850s, you had to have people riding horseback or carriage for 3-4 hours to get there, standing in, I won't say hot sun, but rain or hot sun or whatever the weather was, because it was outdoors, and they were often in the fall, so not always great weather, and two, three hour long debates with no microphones. I mean, you try and speak to 5,000 people. The thing I'm most impressed with is not what they said, but how they could keep their voice up there. That's powerful. And so, but we go from that to the soundbite, as you said. And there was an analysis a couple years ago about how 20 years ago, the average quote of a politician, the soundbite they put on the network news in the 60s, 70s, was average time 44 seconds, now 9 seconds. No new taxes, or just say no, or
where's the beef?
Those quick, punchy lines are catchy, and hey, I've learned that's the way you do things. You got to have a punchline. You try and come up, here one of the tasks always is, you get 10 words or 5 words for a title, what do you say that's a little bit catchy, that might tell people something about what you're talking about. And that's very unhealthy, and I'd say there's a lot of blame to go around. The candidates, the politicians, the media, and the public. I wrote a long, detailed position papers on, how many pages of, 20 pages of position papers, first time I ran for office, and people joked the only person who read them all was my opponent, trying to find out what dirt you could dig up. She edited them all the way. We spent a lot of time on it. We worked hard, and the point is, if people don't read them, why do it? Well, actually, I think there was a lot of merit to it. For one thing, it does help one clarify their thinking when they do that, though most candidates don't write their own position papers. The other thing was, in our legislative districts in Minnesota, unlike some other states, candidates go door to door and talk with people. As I'd go door to door, late summer, early fall, and so on, handing out a brochure and a summary issue paper, you go back several houses later and somebody was sitting out on their porch and you'd be looking back and the person still be reading it 5 minutes later. You know, not everybody reads it, and it helps to have somebody hand it to them and say, please read this. But some people do, and if we don't give, if you give the public fluff, then they learn to expect fluff. And they're not surprised by it. I wouldn't miss for a minute putting pictures in there and other things that are gonna grab people who aren't gonna take the time to read it. But I think there's importance, and candidates don't do their share. Media, good example of this. 3 years ago when I was running for governor, we wanted debates. My opponent was the incumbent. He did not want debates. He was fighting them off and very effectively. Oh, he'd do one that nobody, a radio debate nobody listened to, and he did one in front of the Chamber of Commerce that nobody, it was excerpted in sound bites and nothing else. And we were trying to get the network TV stations to have him, and every one, maybe one of the four major TV stations in the Twin Cities area, challenged us both to have a debate on their station. Only one occurred, and we said yes to every one. Why did only one occur? Because my opponent said no to all of them. Why did one of them win? Because they said, well, if you're not going to have it, we're going to interview him for an hour, free media time. All of a sudden, well, maybe I will go to that one. What if the other stations did that? It takes them 1 minute to. Matter of fact, the governor said, hey, that's not fair. Well, we're giving you the same time. You can show up too. That's all it took. The TV station, they had the guts to go ahead and do it. And the newspapers even don't do a good job of, they all have a responsibility that they're falling down on, and the public has a responsibility to demand it. When you see something that's negative that you hate or unfair, criticize it. If you see two candidates is slightly, one slightly better than the other, since you don't really like either one or really hate the other one, maybe you go for, they're pretty close, factor in how they run a campaign. That says something about who they are, what they stand for. Factor those things into your thought process. And I think the public has a lot of obligation as well, but you're right. There is no easy way for the average voter to get a lot of information. And I can tell you how to get information. I mean, now on internet, you can get a ton of stuff nationally and even locally. All our legislation is on the internet now. And our statutes, everything is on internet. That way, it doesn't always give summaries of things and arguments for things as well as you like. But organizations that share concerns of yours are often good ways to find out where people are on things and how to, what the issues are. But I'd say in a democracy, you need to count on an informed electorate. And in a busy society where people don't have a lot of time, you need to be able to give it to them well. And TV news, which is where most people get their news, half an hour of news, you get 6 minutes of commercials, 5 minutes of weather, 5 minutes of sports, one about a puppy that fell in a well, and two murder stories, and a minute or two for all state, local, national, international politics. And that's where you get the sound bites and you lose everything else. It's sad. It's pathetic. We got one station in the Twin Cities now doing hour-long news. Of course, they put in more features, but they do have a little bit more in-depth. And you fight hard to get change in that. Yes?
Are we still talking about cynicism, or are you looking for a new question?
Anything you want.
Well, I could make one kind of both. Biggest thing that creates cynicism for me is partisan politics. How is it that so many issues with so many thoughtful people on the Hill and statewide can votes come down along party lines? And how, I guess, to turn this into a question, is how in the world can you get past that?
Okay. For one, let me give a couple of comments. I'll try and be briefer because we've got several more questions. One is, it's surprising how many times it doesn't happen. And but you're right, it does happen a lot of times. And as one who's never felt particularly bound, I'm a member of my party because I believe in what the party stands for. And the reason I disagree, I vote against our party leadership so many times is because I don't think they stand for what I thought what I stand for. I mean, I vote for what I stand for. And so I've never felt that obligation. But one time, a couple of years ago, just to show how this works, the governor vetoed one of our big, in Minnesota we have about 6 or 7 omnibus funding bills every biennium. We have a 2-year budget process. And the funding bill for, I don't know what it was, the education or human services or transportation, whichever one, he vetoed one of the bills. What was his objection to it? Well, he was just overall concerned about the budget, and therefore he was going to veto this one just to send a message he didn't like a lot of things in it. It had passed unanimously in both houses. So he attempted to override, and no, it was a party line vote to sustain the veto. Then, and since he didn't say what he didn't like in the bill, he was just complaining overall about other bills, and he wanted to veto several spending bills to make it clear that we couldn't go home without fixing it. So then he came back and everybody settled on what was in dispute in the other bill he was concerned about. And then he said, okay, well, as part of that, I'll sign this other bill if it passes again. So we voted for it again. Unanimously passed. I thought, how would you go back and explain your constituents? I voted for this bill because it was a good thing. Then the governor said no, and I guess, well, he made some good points, so I voted against it then. Mm-hmm. And then he changed his mind, so I changed mine. I wouldn't want to try and do that. And I would say there's a lot of partisan game playing that really goes on. I've seen both parties in the minority where they try and put on amendments on the floor to embarrass the other side. Bad votes you make them cast. Vote to bust the budget by voting to cut the taxes and spend more in the budget process so you can't keep it in balance. And then they get a vote against more funding for all kinds of good things like education and so on. And they get a vote against tax cuts, and everybody likes both of those types of things. So there's a lot of game playing, and the partisan game playing, I would not say, is strictly Democratic versus Republican. They're all other kinds of game playing that, like you mentioned one earlier, the flood relief package and tying those things. And I understand that. I'm not sure exactly that there's a way out of it other than asking people to vote what they believe and not the party thing. I'm a partisan person, and I believe we should have parties, and I work with a party. And it disgusts me to no end when people blindly vote for that party or that interest group or that whatever. And that's, again, where maybe change the people in office. And there's no simple answer. Yes, you know.
Well, one thing maybe contributes to cynicism on the other side mm-hmm. is that politicians have been really getting away of late with saying one thing and voting the other way, and voters still having the impression that they voted for what they said.
Yeah.
Like in the Washington Stadium thing, at one point the contention was that all the taxes they were talking about would be paid by sports fans.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a good trick because it amounted to $50 per ticket per game for 20 years that they would have to raise in taxes off the sports fans going to the game.
Yeah.
But, you know, the last
minute... And then they expanded beyond it and a little bit...
No, the last minute they ditched all those taxes and mm-hmm. it basically comes out of the general fund.
Yeah.
But I've talked to no end of people who still think that, oh, well, it's all coming from a sports fan, so, you know, it's not so bad that mm-hmm. we vote.
No, they really believe that. They definitely mm-hmm. believe it, yeah.
But since it came through that way at one point, that's what's stuck in mind.
It's very clever marketing. Politics mm-hmm. is big in marketing of how you do things well, and it's dishonest. It's political consultants, the good political consultants, and I mean mm-hmm. good, not in the sense of they're good things to have, but the ones who are successful. They learn their limit is what's legal, not what's right. Mm-hmm. And as long as it is factually not something they can sue you over, they can get away with it. And it can be the most cheap, misleading thing in the world. Very easy. If you want to talk about the environment, you don't have to vote for something that people on both sides might consider pro-environment versus pro-whatever the other side is, business, anti-regulation, if it's something like that. You don't portray your environmentalism with a voting record if it's not positive that way. You go out and take pictures of you planting trees and showing how wonderful you much you care about the environment. And the public sees, they know it's happening. They often reward the candidates who do it though. And again, like the negative advertising, they hate it, but they still tend to reward it. And there's no simple way other than trying to politics is one person at a time.
Or the balanced budget. No politician has ever been against the balanced budget.
That's right. And somebody once said, Congress, people say Congress never does what the people want. Well, wait a minute. Public wants to spend more for this, and they want to spend more for this, and they want to spend more for this, and they don't want to pay taxes, which is logical. I mean, they're contradictory wishes, but they're things we all wish. And hey, Congress has done exactly what the public wanted on that. But the public also recognizes it's contradictory, and you hope that they don't want it to be done that way either. So we have time for maybe one more, two more? Any more questions? Yes, go ahead.
It's kind of a personal question, but this is a terrific forum that BLA asks us. What is the hardest thing, or among the hardest things, to maintain your integrity as a politician? And things that come to my mind is, like even tonight, there's a microphone in front of you. You must be aware of that. I don't know if even this tape could be brought up.
This tape could be brought back to Minnesota. I've been to Holden a number of times and spoken here since I've been elected. And
Hasn't yet.
Do about every 4 years. Nobody has brought up anything. When I was wearing a wig right after the buses came this afternoon, that some of the kids got on us, somebody took a picture. This will be in some of your opponent's decks. I call around in Minnesota too. If they're going to do that, there are plenty of chances in Minnesota to get that. I guess what I've tried to do as a personal philosophy for that is recognize that, boy, I care a lot about what I do. And it's the most rewarding and the most frustrating job all at once that I've ever had. And I don't have any divine right or legal claim to the legislative seat I hold or to my job. It's something that the voters give me. And I better be ready to lose at some point. Somehow politicians have this thing, well, I don't dare lose no matter what, and I'm going to stoop to anything to do it. If you don't worry about that every day, and boy, I do work hard to make sure I win an election, and I've won 6 out of 7, and the biggest one, of course, is the one I lost. But I work very hard, and I try very hard, but I also am not going to spend every minute of my waking hours worrying, oh, did I say something wrong? And I think that's the number one problem. And hey, I'm chicken too. I mean, there are lots of times I don't want to say this because I know it's unpopular, I'm going to get hammered for it, and oh boy, I bet you in the next election this is going to come back to haunt me, but I believe in it, and so I agonize. I certainly agonize over things like that, but then in the end, I figure, look, you know, my job representing the people is to do the best I can, try and sell it to them. If I can't persuade them, they should vote against me. If I can persuade them, they'll give me another chance, even if they disagree. They like it that I'm upfront and honest with them. And so I've decided I'm not going to spend every minute worrying about it. And the most wonderful editorial attacking me, St. Paul Pioneer Press 3 years ago endorsed my opponent saying I was honest to a fault. And I hadn't thought of it as a fault, but I figure, I'm not sure, I think they really did think it was a fault. But I hope it was a term of wording or something, but they did endorse my opponent in the process. And I wish people would. The people I respect most in politics are not the ones I agree with most, are the people who, whatever their political philosophy, really believe in something and fight for it, win or lose. You have a good debate, and that's how democracy thrives. And that's what we ought to get back to. And if somehow we could get people away from this, I'm not in favor of term limits, which I know is unpopular, but I don't think term limits does it either. It's an artificial limit. I think we should just tell people, look, don't fight to hang on to your job at all costs. Fight for what you got there for in the first place, if you had a reason. Anyway, I'll cut it off there because it's been an hour, and I'll be around for the next few minutes before Vespers to talk if anybody has more questions informally. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.